Welcome to Central Study Hour here at Sacramento Central Seventh-day Adventist Church. Wherever you may be watching, thank you for joining us this morning and happy Sabbath. Our first song this morning comes to us from Mariano Torres of Argentina. And the song is hymn number 596, Look for the Waymarks. Let's sing together this rousing song, verses 1 through 3.
Your journey on, look for the waymarks passing one by one, down through the ages, past the kingdoms more. Where are we standing? Look the waymarks more. Look for the waymarks, the great prophetic waymarks, down through the ages, past the kingdoms more. Assyrian kingdom ruled the world, then made of Persia's banners were unfurled, and after Greece held universal sway, Rome seized the scepter. Where are we today? Look for the waymarks, the great prophetic waymarks, down through the ages, past the kingdoms fall.
Reminder of our journey, isn't it? It's almost done. Thank you, Mariana, for sending that in. And if you have a special song request, we'd like to sing it with you. Please visit our website here at saccentral.org. Click on the contact us link. Tell us who you are, where you're from, and of course, the title of the hymn you've selected. And we'll be happy, delighted to sing it with you on an upcoming Sabbath. Our next hymn is a request from Barbara, and she is from England, and this song is entitled, My Shepherd Will Supply My Need, hymn number 104. Let's sing this lovely hymn together.
In pastures fresh, he made
Let's bow our heads for prayer. Our most gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are our shepherd and that you supply our need and that we don't have to worry, we don't have to be afraid, but just simply trust in you that you will provide. We ask that you will strengthen us and help us to be more like you so that one day that we can be in heaven together, never more to roam. I ask that you will send your Holy Spirit to be with us as we open up Sabbath school. May your Spirit speak to each of our hearts. Bless those who hear and those who will be speaking. In Jesus' name I pray, amen. Our Sabbath school lesson will be presented by Pastor Chris Buttery, senior pastor here at Sacramento Central Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Thank you, Jennifer, Jesse, and Eleni. Appreciate that. Good morning, everyone. Some really neat songs there that we sang this morning. Did you recognize the first hymn, what that was referring to, or at least what prophecy in the Bible it was referring to? Daniel chapter 2, right? Feet nine of clay and feet of iron and clay. Very interesting, yeah. So we have we are looking at lesson number 5 today. We're moving right into our study. We want to welcome those that are tuning in, of course, joining us. We always have a free offer for you. It's offer C21944. And it's all you need to do to receive a CD or DVD, a copy of that free gift, is call 916-457-6511 or email us at csh@saccentral.org. We'll be happy to get that right out to you. Of course, you can go to our website, and if you don't have a copy of this study lesson, you can click on the CSH banner, and you'll be able to get everything there that you need. So we are in lesson number 5, violating the spirit of the law. What could this possibly be about? We're going to be digging into a story in the book of Nehemiah, particularly chapter 5. And so if you have your Bibles and study guides, let's open those together and we'll be delving into this study together. By the way, the memory text is Nehemiah 5 verse 11. Let me read that for us this morning. It says, "Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, as a hundredth of the money and the grain, the new wine and the oil that you have charged them." As we get into the story, we're going to learn a little bit more about what who is asking for this, why the person is asking for it, and what the response was to that appeal. But essentially, today's lesson has to do with money. More specifically, those that don't have enough and those that have too much. And of course, as the lesson brings out, humanity has often struggled with questions of wealth and poverty and the gap between the rich and the poor. And of course, in certain countries, that gap between rich and poor is incredible. There's a great divide. In first world countries, not so much, but there is a growing divide and it's there. And it's hard to escape. And the government tries to offer all types of different solutions. And of course, we're grateful for that. I mean, do we follow a economic plan of trickle down economics, or do we follow one that says trickle up? Which one do we follow? And then, of course, putting people back to work is always a good thing. Getting individuals, making work opportunities for people to labor so they can earn their way through and in the world is always a good thing. But then you have those that unfortunately seek to abuse their employees and don't maybe pay the wages they ought to pay. And so there's regulations that are needed. And sometimes we over-regulate and sometimes under-regulate. And it's a struggle and it's an ongoing challenge. As a matter of fact, when you look in James chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, the Bible tells us very clearly that labor issues are going to continue with us right through even till the close of time. James talks about the rich and how they oppress those who reap their fields and don't pay them their proper wages. And so labor wage disputes are going to continue even till Jesus comes. It's an issue that we are going to face. As a matter of fact, Jesus said, "The poor will have with us always." And that doesn't mean we should turn a blind eye to the needs of those who are less fortunate. We are to do what we can as Christians. We're exhorted to do so. But in the story in particular that we're going to look at in Nehemiah 5, it has to do with this issue, the rich really exploiting the poor and those that are without. And this story occurs after the return of the exiles from the Persian kingdom, Babylon, Persia. They return to Jerusalem, and there is this issue that is going on, the rich oppressing the poor. And at the bottom of the Sabbath afternoon's lesson, the author says that we need to be careful, and this was the issue, that there were certain laws that were in place, and we'll look at this a little closer. There were certain laws in place. The laws themselves, the letter of the law wasn't being violated except maybe in one area. It was the spirit of the law that was being violated. And the author says how we need to be careful not to let rules and regulations become an end in and of themselves, rather a means to an end, which is to reflect the character of Jesus. I like that a lot. The Bible often talks about the need to be careful we are following the spirit of the law. And Paul makes some very strong statements with regard to the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. 2 Corinthians 3 particularly, I've just been reading that for my worship the last couple of days, where he talks about you have folk who are exalting the letter of the law to the detriment of the spirit. And he was referring to the Judaizers of his day who were encouraging the Gentile Christians to first become Jews before they became Christians. And it was necessary for salvation for men to be circumcised. And so, which was a very unfortunate teaching, because salvation comes through faith in Jesus Christ. And so they were exalting the letter above the spirit. And anyway, we see in this lesson that the rich were, while heeding the letter of the law in most respects, were violating the spirit of it. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. You know, this in this particular story too, we also learn how we can deal with discord and division that may exist among God's people in the church. The story was told of a mum who was inside in the home, and she had her kids, had some friends over playing with her kids, and they were out there in the backyard. And the noise in the backyard went from a regular noise that kids will make, joyful, playful noise, to this aggravated noise in the backyard. There seemed to be anger. There seemed to be fighting and arguing. And so mum went out to find out what was going on. And she asked her kids, what's happening out here? Is everything okay? And one of the children responded to mum, "Mum, it's okay. We're just playing church." Unfortunately, the church is often marked more by fracture than by fellowship. And certainly we know that the devil is behind that. What is his aim in bringing division into the church and discord into the church? It's to delay, essentially, the work of God, to try to detain the work that's needing to be done. And when we look at this story in the book of Nehemiah, God's people are doing a great work. What are they doing? They're building a wall. That wall will protect the inhabitants of the city. And then, of course, they can build inside without the threat of enemy coming in to destroy. And so it was a great work that was going on. And for all accounts and purposes, there seemed like there was great unity inside among God's people. After all, you had the enemy coming in, seeking to delay and frustrate and hinder the work that they were doing. But really, inside Jerusalem, in and among God's people, there was actually fracture. They were not whole, and we'll discuss this in just a little bit. But how does the devil seek to delay God's work? How does he do that? As a matter of fact, in the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah shares with us several instances of how he seeks to delay or stop God's work. One of them is disinterest in the church, disinterest. In Nehemiah chapter 3 and verse 5, Nehemiah is listing all the families and the individuals who are working by family, by group on the wall. They're each assigned their place, and he lists a group called the Tekoites, and they are laboring and working on the wall. But the Bible says something interesting in Nehemiah 3 verse 5. It says that the nobles refused to work. So here you had the Tekoites working, but the nobles, the rulers of that family group, refused to lift a hand to work. They were disinterested in the work. So the devil was seeking to bring disinterest into the work, because disinterest breeds disinterest. A cavalier kind of attitude toward God's work. And so that's one area in which the devil seeks to delay or hinder, stop God's work. Another thing that he tries to bring into the church, in among God's people, is discouragement. Discouragement. And you'll see that in Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 10 through 12. Nehemiah 4, verses 10 through 12, there was kind of like a proverb or a song that was being sung by the builders of the wall. And it went something like this: "The strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall." So what was happening is you had people looking at all the piles of rubbish that had built over the years, the decades, and it was all in the way, hindering them from getting in to do the work of building the wall. And there were individuals who were voicing their discouragement, and that discouragement went up and down the ranks. "Too much rubbish, can't build the walls, hindering us." And when people voice discouragement, discouragement finds friends pretty quickly, doesn't it? So there are others who became discouraged as well. And so this proverb, this proverb went throughout the land and brought discouragement to God's people. Then when you continue reading there in Nehemiah 4 and verses 11 and 12, the devil also brings in an attitude of defeatism. So first he brings disinterest, second he brings discouragement, then he brings an attitude of defeatism. Look at verses 11 and 12. He said, "They are now, our adversaries say, they will neither now nor see anything till we come in their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us." So you had a group of individuals, and this is very interesting, who were not working on the wall, but were living near the enemy. And they kept hearing the enemy's plans, that they were going to come in and they were going to do harm to God's people. And so those who were living next to the enemy, who had not lifted a finger to build the wall, brought these concerns to the people there in Jerusalem and shared those concerns, an attitude of defeatism, an attitude of despair. "We're not going to get it done because the enemy's going to come in and they're going to do us harm." You can see how these things can really hinder the work there and, of course, hinder the work of the church. Attitudes of disinterest, discouragement, defeatism. So how did Nehemiah deal with those types of things? Well, if you look at verses 13 and 14 in Nehemiah 4, and we're going to get to our lesson here in just a minute, because there's another D that the devil brings into the church to try to hinder the work of God, and it has to do with our story in Nehemiah 5. But if you look at verses 13 and 14 of Nehemiah 4, what did Nehemiah do? He responded. Essentially, Nehemiah encouraged the people to depend upon the Lord and to defend themselves. So verse 13, he's equipping the families with swords, and some have weapons to defend themselves, and in one hand, and in the other hand, they've got work tools so they can build the wall. And he called upon the people to stop looking at the problem and focus their eyes upon the power of the Lord. And that's very important, because often humanity, if you're anything like me, and I'm sure we're a little bit this way, some are maybe a little more pessimistic than others, some are more optimistic, half glass full people or half empty glass people. But no matter which way you cut it, humanity kind of has a bit of a tendency to focus on the problem rather than the solution. And so he called God's people to focus on the Lord who is mighty to save. And you read that in verses 13 and 14. And he also encouraged them to defend themselves by clothing themselves in armor. And the call, of course, for us, for you and for me, is we defend the cause, we defend God's work, we defend ourselves from the attacks of the enemy by clothing ourselves in the armor of God, don't we? Truly. There's some great parallels here to the work of the church and to you and me today. But the devil will try to delay God's work. He'll introduce these delay devices of disinterest, discouragement, defeatism. And he'll also bring in discord. He'll also bring in discord. And so let's look at Sunday's lesson. We're in Nehemiah chapter 5, and the whole chapter really deals with this conflict that was that existed within Jerusalem at that particular time. So what's happening here in Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, let's read this together. It says, "And there was a great outcry of the people." So there's something really serious going on here. "And their wives against their Jewish brethren. For there were those who said, 'We, our sons and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live.'" What's the implication? What's being said here? What's happening? Essentially, there's a famine. That's right, Dina. Yeah, there's a famine and there's shortage of food. And so they're saying, look, we need to eat, we need to get grain so that we might eat and live. There's a shortage of food, insomuch that people are starving. Verse 3. "There were also some who said, 'We have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine.'" So they didn't have resources or money to buy the grain, the grain of food, so that they might eat and live. They had to mortgage their property in order to have the funds to be able to buy the food. But it gets worse. Verse 4. "There were also those who said, 'We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards.'" So here they've mortgaged the land, and yet they still have to pay taxes on the land. And this tax, of course, came from the Persian government, and it was a hefty tax. And I think the lesson brings that out of 350 talents of silver annually. If they didn't pay that, they would lose possession of their land. So they were paying, they had to borrow money in order to pay taxes on the land. Talk about maxing out your credit card. Here they're maxing out their credit card. And then we go to verse 5. It says, "Yet now," now notice, here is, that's a problem in and of itself, but notice how the problem is being exacerbated and by who? Verse 5. "Yet now our own flesh," our own brothers and sisters, "yet now our flesh is as the children of our brethren, our children as their children, and indeed we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and our vineyards." So you can see the major problem here. There's a famine, there's a shortage of food, and the poor don't have much to purchase the food, so they're mortgaging their land. And so they have the money to purchase the food, yet they have to borrow money to pay the taxes so they can keep their land. But some have lost their land, so they cannot use the land to redeem or buy back their own sons and daughters that they have used as collateral while they're gathering resources and money to pay back the creditors. You see the problem? This is a major issue, a major issue. And so how would we summarize here this problem? What are the people crying out against? What are they crying out against? Essentially, the poorer Jews were complaining against the wealthy Jews who were ignoring their desperate needs, and these wealthy Jews were making the matter worse by exploiting the poor Jews. So this isn't some foreign nation that's come in to buy the land or to ask for the sons and the daughters as collateral while they gather money to pay back their creditor. No, no, no. This is their own brethren. This is their own brethren. This is their own brothers and sisters who are exploiting them for their own personal gain. The problem? The love of money. That's the problem. It's a big issue here. You know, it's been said that we have more to fear from within than from without. And we talked here a little bit about those delay devices of the devil: disinterest, discouragement, defeatism. But he also brings in discord, and he'll bring it in any way he can so that God's work might be halted, might be stopped, might be frustrated. So essentially, the poor were in a spiral, and there was no way of getting out of this spiral. They were going down. Real, real big problem. There's a lesson. There's a question at the bottom of Sunday's lesson, and it says, "How fascinating that then, as now, people struggle with economic oppression. What message should we take from the fact that this is a topic the Bible often addresses?" Last quarter, we spent all of last quarter's study dealing with justice and mercy and helping those who have real genuine needs. And here we have another story or another lesson in Nehemiah 5 that deals with something very similar, except this is happening in the church, happening among God's people. So what do we take from the fact that the Bible brings this issue up time and time again? Well, maybe one, it's a fact of life, isn't it? People are greedy. People are selfish. The fact of life, Jesus said that the poor will be with us always. Some through choices of their own, some because they've hit hard times and things are out of their hands. For whatever reason, Jesus said, the poor will be with us always. And if this is going to be a state of affairs all the time, then how should God's people respond and react? Well, we should always be vigilant and work against oppression and exploitation, shouldn't we? We have a voice, we have pens, we can talk to our representatives. We can certainly do that. We have to make sure that within the church, of course, we're not, no one's exploited. The needs are being taken care of the best way possible. And of course, the important thing is that God's people are being honest and true and kind and merciful to others. And so the devil brought in discord through this exploitation of the rich over the poor. So let's continue the story. Let's go into Monday's lesson and against the spirit of the law. Now, wherever there is strife and discord, God has offered a way of escape. This story brings out ways, strategies in which to deal with discord in the church, settling strife, defeating discord that exists, whether it be in the home, whether it be in the church. There are some really important principles that we can garner from the way Nehemiah handled this situation. The first thing and the important thing here as we move into the story a little bit further, and that is, did Nehemiah shrug off the concern, or did he stop the work on the wall to deal with this issue? He didn't shrug it off, did he? He said, let's stop what we're doing. He could have said, just give me 4, 5, 6 more weeks and I'll deal with the issue. But he said, no, we're going to stop what we're doing. This is a big issue. Let's deal with it. And so that's very important. We recognize that. He stopped to deal with it. And no matter what the challenges of that, of the confrontation would garner, he had to talk with the rich, the untouchables, in order to address this issue. But he wasn't going to cower, he wasn't going to be afraid, and so he addressed the issue. So how can we settle strife? What are some of the solutions for defeating discord, whether in the home, whether in the church? Well, number one, we need to disclose any disapproval to the right person. We need to share our disapproval, share the concern with the right person. And we don't know in the story whether the individuals here that made this great outcry went to the rich first to talk with them about the problems and address the issue first. We don't know that, or whether they just declared the problem and it got out. We're not entirely sure exactly what happened there. But the important thing is that whenever there is a disagreement, that we go to the person that the disagreement, we have a disagreement with, or the disagreement is with that person. That's following the Matthew 18 principle, isn't it? Jesus said, if you have aught with your brother, go to them. If they don't hear you, take someone else as a witness. If they don't hear, then bring it to the church. There's three steps in the process. But the most important thing, and when people come to me and say, Pastor, there's an issue and there's a problem and this person, that person, the other thing, and that never happens here, of course, but when it's happened, my first question is, have you talked to the person that you have a problem with? Because I'm not going to deal with it until you have. Because that's what Jesus said. You need to talk to the person. If you have a problem, you have a problem with that person, or that person has a problem with you, you need to deal with it personally, the two of you, right there. So always disclose the disapproval to the right person. Sometimes there are individuals who just kind of noise abroad their concern. And sometimes it happens in the church. Folk get a little concerned about certain things, and they start sharing their concerns with other people. And when they're found out, they say, well, I was just testing the waters to see if I was the only one, The only one that had the problem, just seeing what other people thought. And the word kind of gets out, and rumors begin, and it's not always the best way. And the leader, the pastor, the elder, they're the last ones to find out. Here's a rule of thumb. If you want the leader to address the problem, let the leader know what the problem is. That's always an important lesson to keep in mind, right? And so to settle strife, defeat discord, we need to always just close the disapproval to the right person. And then secondly, we need to deal with that disapproval in a biblical manner. We need to deal with the disapproval in a biblical manner, not sweep it under the carpet, not hope that it will go away or disappear, but to deal with it and deal with it in a biblical manner. So let's take a look at how Nehemiah handled it, and we'll learn some lessons from Nehemiah, okay? So let's go to Nehemiah 5, verses 6 and 8. And under that title, deal with disapproval in a biblical manner, I'm going to share with you, five different ways in which, well, not different ways, but five areas in which we can handle a situation in a biblical manner. And Nehemiah will help us with that. So let's look at verses 6 through 8. Well, as a matter of fact, let's begin with verse 6. So, Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 6, "And I became very angry when I heard their outcry and these words." So why does Nehemiah become angry? Because there's injustice going on, that's right. There's injustice going on. You have the rich exploiting the poor for their own gain. This is happening in church. It's like, this is, of all places, this should not be happening. And so he's angry. As a matter of fact, there are a couple of Bible verses in the Old Testament. I'm not going to read them here this morning. I'm just going to give you the references so you can see the context in which Nehemiah was thinking. But there's one that's already in the lesson, and it's Exodus 21, verses 2 through 7. The idea that a son or a daughter could be sold into slavery was permissible by law. According to the laws established, the judgments established, the civil laws established at the foot of Mount Sinai when God was organizing his people. That's in Exodus 21, verses 2 through 7. But we need to remember, even though slavery was a cultural norm in that particular day, God mitigated the evils of slavery among his own people, in so much that when you read the rules surrounding this, you get the very strong impression that God doesn't approve of it, period. But he gave them rules and parameters to work within, and it should be noted that there was no such thing as permanent involuntary servitude among Israel. In the culture, in the nations around Israel at that time, prodigiously wicked, slavery was slavery. People were treated like animals, subject to beatings, subject to injustices. But among God's people, if there was a need for someone, for collateral to labor for a family to pay off a debt, that person was to be considered a brother or a sister, a part of the family, and treated as such. And they were not to be permanent servants of that family. As a matter of fact, every 7 years? That's right. Every 7 years, they were to release those that who had been taken into servanthood and go back to their own families. And there were, if you read the Exodus 21, there are some details in there that are important to understand. Another passage to look at is Exodus 22, verse 25, and there are other verses in the Old Testament that refer to this, but God's told his people that you can loan money, but when you loan money to your brother or your sister, don't ask for interest. The Bible uses the word usury, U-S-U-R-Y, usury or interest. But here in this story, God's people were asking interest of the loans that they had given, which they were breaking that particular civil law. And so this, of course, made Nehemiah upset as well. And then Leviticus 25 talks about the sale of land. And if you sold your land, you could actually get your land back on the year of Jubilee. Seven year cycles. And so this was all designed to mitigate greed and to provide, make sure people were well provided for. I mean, it was just a pretty incredible system God had set up here. But it's important to recognize that Nehemiah wasn't just angry at the fact that that folk had loaned money with interest. He wasn't just angry at that. He was angry at the fact that even though these things were permitted, sale of the children as collateral to work to pay off the debt, the sale of the land, even though these things were permissible, Nehemiah was still upset because he figured that if Israel had done the right thing and were doing the right thing by one another, none of this should ever happen. None of this should ever happen. And of course, you have the rich exploiting the poor. So this definitely shouldn't be happening at all. But here's the first point under dealing with disapproval in a biblical manner. It's okay to get angry. We'll qualify that. Ephesians 4:20. Is there an anger that doesn't sin? Yeah, Ephesians 4:26 says, be angry and sin not. But if you go over to verse 31 of Ephesians chapter 4, Paul says, you're a new man, so put off anger, malice, bitterness. So there is a righteous anger, and then there is an anger that is premised upon selfishness. Maybe a person is has been embarrassed, pride has been injured, and when the anger stems from that selfish premise, then that's the anger we need to give to the Lord. But here Nehemiah got angry, and it was a righteous anger. It was an anger that actually propelled him to take action. It was an anger toward unjust treatment. And so it's okay to have an anger toward unjust treatment. It's okay to be angry at child abuse and the sex trafficking that occurs throughout this nation, even here in our back doorstep. It's okay to be angry at abortion. It's okay to be angry at racism. It's okay to be angry when someone is seeking to undermine the cause of God. It's okay to be angry when someone is propagating a falsehood, doing harm to God's truth. It's okay. But don't get bitter. Don't hold on to it and let it ruin your life. That's righteous anger is designed to propel us to action. And so to deal with disapproval in a biblical manner, it's okay to be angry when there's unjust treatment. And then number two, let's take a look at Nehemiah 5 and verse 7. We read there in verse 6 that he became angry when he heard the outcry. Look at verse 7, the first part. And after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and the elders. So what did he do? He was driven by his anger and went off in a huff, and he gave it to those nobles and to those elders? No. He paused. And it says that he gave some serious thought to the matter. He prayed about it. He thought about it. He talked to the Lord about it. He exercised, in other words, self-control. And so whenever there's a disagreement, a dispute, people ought to always exercise self-control, be measured, always be measured. So he exercised self-control. He consulted with himself before dealing with the situation. And then number three, dealing with disapproval in a biblical manner, he confronted the problem. Now look at the second part of verse 7. So after I gave it serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and the elders, the rulers, and I said to them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. So I called a great assembly against them. So Nehemiah went to them personally. He didn't air the grievance publicly. He went to them personally, and he confronted the nobles, the rich, these individuals, the rich rulers, with the problem. And he told them that you are exacting usury or interest from your brother. And so after he had talked with them, perhaps he didn't really get far with them. He then called a general assembly. He called all the people together, perhaps with the idea that as the people heard the complaint and the issue, that it might motivate the rulers to take some action because they might be embarrassed about what they were doing, you see. So Nehemiah confronted the problem, even with the risk, and this is very important, even with the risk of offending a ruler, even with the risk of offending someone of influence, the untouchables, right? The untouchables, the nobles. So whether they were influential, an influential noble, whether they were an academic noble, whatever noble they were, he confronted them. And it's important. Sometimes people get a little concerned about confronting anyone of influence because of potentially the outcome that could follow from that. And sometimes the church gets into problems with that. They won't sit down and talk with someone who's a big tithe contributor or who's doing a big work for God, but there's an issue that needs to be confronted. And churches ought not be afraid. We got to do the right thing all the time. Isn't that right? Irrespective of the consequences. Whether that person's offering drops off because they were offended, it doesn't matter. If we can save a person from their wrongdoing and they'll find a place in heaven, that's more important than funding a person, a project, a local project here and now. Would you agree with me? And so he confronted the problem. And it's not always easy to confront the problem, but he did so. All right, let's go to Tuesday's lesson. And we're going to look here at a fourth aspect of dealing with disapproval in a biblical manner. Let's look at Nehemiah chapter 5, and we'll read from verse 8. And so he called this great assembly, and he said to them, according to our ability, he's talking about himself and some of his brethren. He said, according to our ability, we've redeemed our Jewish brethren who are sold to the nations. Now indeed, will you even sell your brethren? Or should they be sold to us? Then they were silenced and found nothing to say. Verse 9, then I said, what you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? All right. So what's Nehemiah's arguments here about what's going on? What does he use to persuade the people that they are doing the wrong thing? Did you see that there? First of all, he states that he and his brethren actually have redeemed Jews from foreign lands, purchased them back so they can come back home and live here. And then he said, we bring them back and then you're gonna make them a slave here? It's a pretty powerful argument. And he uses himself as an example, not because he's proud or he's boasting about the good things that he and some of his brethren are doing, but he's giving it as an example. And he's showing the contrast between what he's doing and between what they've been doing. It's a pretty good tactic, isn't it? So he says, look, we're redeeming Jews from other nations, but then you're going to sell your brothers, your sisters? What's that all about? And then what else did he use to try to encourage them and help them see they were doing the wrong thing? What did he say? He said, our enemies, you're going to cause a massive reproach to come upon our, the enemies are going to make fun of us. They're going to mock us. They're going to say, look at how those people who profess to be the people of God treat each other. And so they listened. They listened to what Nehemiah had to say. As a matter of fact, if you look at verse 10, it says, I also with my brethren and my servants am lending them money and grain. So please stop this usury. Stop asking for interest on the loans you've made. And that brings us to our fourth point under that banner, dealing with disapproval in a biblical manner. And that is exemplifying Christ-likeness. Exemplifying Christ-likeness. You know, honestly, there is a hesitancy to confront those in sin because when you're pointing at somebody, there are three fingers pointing at you and people can quickly say, well, you know, you're not my judge, or they may even bring up something they know that you're doing that's not right as well. So we're often reluctant to confront the wrong. So what does that mean? That means that you and I must be above reproach before dealing with any wrong. We certainly ought not be falling into the same trap of the offending party, the thing we're seeking to correct. And Nehemiah certainly wasn't. He was above reproach, wasn't he? What was he doing? Out of his own resources himself, and Nehemiah obviously was a wealthy man, but out of his own resources, he was helping purchase grain for the poor himself. He wasn't even loaning money. He was buying it for them. And he certainly wasn't paying or charging any interest on what he was doing. So he was giving them the grain. He was buying them grain and helping them out. Let's continue reading here. Verse 10, he says, stop. And verse 11, he says, now restore to them even this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, also a hundredth of the money, the grain, the new wine, the oil you have charged them. That's our memory verse. We read that earlier at the beginning of the lesson. So now we know who said it. Now we know the context in which he said it. And now we know why he said what he said and why he was appealing. So he's asking for them to do what? To restore what they've taken. You know, it kind of reminds me of the story of Zacchaeus, doesn't it? Did Zacchaeus restore? Zacchaeus was a cheat, wasn't he? A tax collector, he was a cheat. And Jesus saw him up there in the sycamore tree. He said, okay, Zacchaeus, come down. I want to eat at your house. And so Zacchaeus said, Lord, what I have, I've given half of to the poor. And those that I've robbed from, I've given back fourfold. And what did Jesus say in response to what Zacchaeus said? Today has salvation come to this house. Genuine redemption, genuine salvation, genuine repentance is always seen in making restitution. If you've said something that's offended somebody, and maybe you didn't even know, but you came to find out, genuine Christianity says, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. I didn't mean to. And if you know you did when you said it, you ought to make restitution right away, right? If you've stolen something, then you pay it back. If you've hurt somebody, you say you apologize and you make restitution. When Zacchaeus had made restitution, Jesus said salvation had come to his house. True salvation had come because Zacchaeus had received Jesus into his life and into his heart. And so Nehemiah here calls for the people who've done wrong to make restitution. All right. And so what do they say? We'll restore it. And we will require nothing from them. We will do as you say. Now, I don't know about you, but Nehemiah may have just for a moment kind of stumbled when he heard the response, because that's not a typical response from human beings. When you're confronted, what's the first thing? What happens when we're confronted with an issue? We get offended. We're so easily offended. Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. If you love God's law, if you love Jesus, you won't be offended. You won't be offended. But we get offended so easily. But here they accept their responsibility. Powerful. Let's go over to Wednesday's lesson, an oath. An oath. So dealing with disapproval in a biblical manner involves righteous anger, exercising self-control, confronting the problem, and exemplifying Christ's likeness. It also requires accountability. It also requires accountability. Let's look at verses 12 and 13. It says, so they said, we'll restore it. We'll require nothing from them. We will do as you say. Then I called the priests and required an oath. Now notice, Nehemiah didn't say, okay, great, thank you. I'll take your word for it. What did he do? He called them together and he required a what? An oath from them that they would do according to this promise. So in front of everybody, he asked them to make a pledge, an oath, a promise that they will follow through with what they've said. And then I shook out the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out each man from his own house and from his property who does not perform this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And so kind of like the prophets of old, Nehemiah, like it's an acted out parable. He shakes his garment as an illustration of those who, look, if you don't do what you've promised here, may you be shaken out of your house, out of your land. May you lose everything. I mean, it's a solemn oath. Solemn pledge here, and he asked them. I mean, he didn't make them, but he asked them, if you're going to make this promise, then let's make it public. Let's make an oath. Let's put it in writing. And they didn't respond and say, Nehemiah, Don't you trust us? Don't you trust us? Look, when a person's done wrong, there needs to be time given to restore that trust. Isn't that right? There always needs to be. Does that mean you haven't forgiven a person because they've done you wrong? No, it means you have forgiven them. But sometimes if you have a family member, or if you have a friend that's a habitual stealer, they come to your house, something always goes missing. You've confronted them. You know that they've taken something. When then when they're confronted, they apologize. They say, "Look, I'm sorry." They restore what they've stolen to you. That's wonderful. Great, great thing. But then do you leave all those things out again to tempt them? I wouldn't. I'll just be honest with you. I wouldn't. Certainly wouldn't leave my wallet around or my phone or my computer, something of value, right? Is it because I haven't forgiven them? No. It's because trust needs to be reestablished. I'm not sure that they're going to follow through. They've actually stopped what they said they'll stop doing. So sometimes there needs to be that trust restored. So accountability. And so they make this oath. How important was an oath in those days? Well, very serious. And there's a whole bunch of Bible verses here we could look at. Numbers 30, verse 2. We don't have time. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 21 to 23. Ecclesiastes 5, and so on. As a matter of fact, in Psalm 15, the question is asked, "Who, O Lord, will ascend into your holy hill?" The question is, who has a right to your kingdom? Who has a right to eternal life? And David goes on to list some of the attributes of the saved. And one of those attributes, he says that those who have access to the kingdom are those who will even swear to their own hurt, but do not change. Interesting. So someone makes a promise, they're going to keep it, even if it does them harm and does them wrong. Isn't that interesting? Someone who will stick by their word. Now, we don't make oaths today and we don't swear today. I swear in the name of, or whoever that I'm going to. We don't do that. What did Jesus say? Let your yes be yes and your no be no, right? So when we say yes, that should be it, right? A man is as good as his word. Well, at least it used to be. And now we have contracts, and now we have lawyers writing out contracts and all the verbose language because we can't trust a person's word anymore. Should people be able to trust a Christian's word? Oh man, they better be able to, right? And you know, when we stop and think about it, we use our language loosely. We tell people we'll show up when we had no intention of showing up. We tell people they look good when they don't look good. You know, we can be pretty flippant, right? And so we're confronted with the issue, okay, if we're going to be honest, then how do I address those types of things? When someone says, "Do I look good today?" What do you say? You've got to be honest. But we can be flippant with our words, can't we? And we just kind of brush it off. It's okay. At least I didn't offend. But then we lied. Is that all right? No, we've got to be careful. So we've got to be careful with the words that we use, the importance of our words. Our words can do harm. Our words can heal. Our words can wound. And I'm always thinking about the power of father's words. There's a little book that I have in my library I like to share with fathers from time to time. And really the book is about the power of a father's words on their children. I knew it, but when I read the book, I really knew it. And I had to be very careful about the words I chose and used with my children. And primarily the words of affirmation for my kids. I look at my boy, tell my boy, "My son, I'm proud of you." You know, he's not like that anymore. He's like here right now. So, "Son, I'm proud of you." You know, and daughters, my daughters, "You're beautiful. No matter what anyone says, you're beautiful here and here. You're beautiful." And I don't understand. I only understand when they're said to me. But they're powerful words. Father's words on their children are powerful, and for their wives. And wives' words are powerful too. Each of our words have an effect. So we ought to be careful, ought we not, with our words? Someone said that in church quarrels, Satan remains neutral and he feeds ammunition to both sides. And he certainly does, doesn't he? But we don't need to accept his ammunition. We just can follow these principles, biblical principles in dealing with differences, and let God work out those differences as we employ these important principles in our relationships with one another. What do you say out there? May God help us to be faithful and true to him, to always be just and true in our dealings. Micah 6:8, he has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? I pray that's your prayer today, and it's mine as well. Thank you for joining us. Glad you're able to tune in. Don't forget your free offer. It's offer C21944. Call 916-457-6511 or email us at csh@saccentral.org. We'll be happy to get that out to you, CD or DVD. Let us know which one. Give us your full address. And this offer is for those in North American territories only. And we look forward to seeing you next week as we continue our journey in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. God bless you.